out, everybody.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
I have a great episode for you. We had to dig deep into the Warren files, which I thought were over. I thought we had really covered the full gambit of Ed and Lorraine Warren's paranormal files, but yeah, here we are.
There's always one more.
Always one more. So today we're going to be talking about the Beckwith family haunting, a family that was tormented by what they believe to be a demonic entity, amongst other spirits as well. Truly crazy story, but one that, you know, as always, may have some alternative theories to it. But let's go ahead and just dive right in. So our story begins in 1998. The Beckwith family began searching for a new home. Bonnie, who's a nurse, and Sean, who's a repairman, had three children, teenage daughters, Francis and Jennifer, and their 9-year-old son, Jeremy. Bonnie and Sean had wanted something more spacious for everyone, so they decided to start searching for a larger home. The family drove around Connecticut's Naugatuck River Valley area looking for possible suitors. That's when they found themselves outside of a home on Buckingham Road in the town of Seymour. Seymour is a small area in the southwest part of the state, and locals have described it as charming, and it has a very rich history. It was originally called Shoestown and was a Native American fishing community as it sits along the Naugatuck River. The Paugusic Scaticook tribes inhabited the area until the 1600s when settlers took over the land. Then during the 18th and 19th centuries, the area had an industrial boom. And in the late 90s, when this story takes place, about 14,000 people lived there, and residents described the town as quaint. The Beckwith family seemed to agree. One day, while driving around town looking for a new home, they found a house on Buckingham Road. From the outside, the house looked perfect for the family. It had 5 bedrooms and 1 bathroom, which fit their needs. Bonnie and Sean called the real estate agent and arranged a tour. As they viewed the home, Jennifer and Jeremy were excited about the idea of moving in. Frances, however, did not like the house. She told her family it gave her a bad feeling and did not want to stay there. The house had been empty for a while and was listed at a very low price, which Bonnie and Sean thought was a great deal. After the tour, they held a family meeting, and while everyone wanted to move in, Frances said she felt like the home was evil. While there didn't seem to be anything in the physical realm that caused her to believe this, the feeling was too strong to ignore. She asked her family to consider not moving in, but she was outvoted by everyone else, who were very enthusiastic about it. So Bonnie and Sean put in an offer, and before long, the Beckwith family had their new home. Unfortunately, Francis's feelings about the home proved true after the family moved in. At first, the new home felt full of excitement. Bonnie and Sean saw it as the start of a new chapter, and the kids were happy to finally have their own rooms. But that excitement changed to fear the very first night that they were there. Around 11 p.m., Jeremy suddenly woke up from the sound of voices. It was like an orchestra of whispers coming from every direction and just growing louder and louder. He ran out of his room and woke up his parents in a panic. And Bonnie thought Jeremy was just scared. You know, he's just staying in a new place for the first time. Maybe that's why he was panicked. The house was bigger and more drafty than their last one, so maybe he really was just hearing things and his imagination was just getting the best of him over what it could be. She calmed him down and then took him back to his room. She then came across his toy flashlight that had different colored lenses, and when Jeremy got back in bed, she gave it to him and told him that if there were any monsters, shining the green light would make them go away, which he seemed to believe. So with his flashlight in hand, Jeremy felt safer and soon fell asleep as Bonnie went back to her room. A few hours later, Jeremy woke up again, this time to loud banging on his wall. Startled, he grabbed his flashlight to shine the green light around his room, but it didn't make the monster go away. A huge black figure moved through the light and loomed over Jeremy. He hid under his blanket, but it was yanked away and thrown across the room. The figure had vanished, but he still screamed and ran out of his room in terror. From then on, at around 11 p.m. every night, Jeremy was terrorized by the unseen being in his room. He'd wake up to the sound of voices or banging, and he would try to use his green flashlight to protect himself, but it was no match for the presence that was there. The family didn't know how to handle what was going on with Jeremy. It was easy for them to assume that maybe this transition to this new place was having a negative effect on him. But all this seemed like just too much to be explained away by a child's imagination. It soon became clear that he wasn't making anything up when other members of the Beckwith family began to have their own bizarre experiences. A few weeks later, Jennifer started to randomly get a weird feeling. All of a sudden, she'd be struck by sudden fear and feel as if someone was staring at her. The feeling grew stronger as the days went on, and she felt like someone was watching her every move, even when she knew no one was around. She especially felt this way when she was in her room. When the family first moved in, Jennifer had loved her room. It was further away from her parents' room, and she had proudly made it her own by decorating it just the way that she wanted to. But as the weeks went by, she inexplicably felt uncomfortable whenever she was in there, and even struggled to sleep at night. Jennifer tried to ignore the strange feeling, but it became too strong, and one night, she suddenly woke up when she felt something push up through the mattress. It felt like someone was punching through it. But when she looked under the bed, of course, nothing was there. Even though she was terrified, she didn't want to wake up her parents. Instead, she just moved her bed to a different spot in her room. And although that kind of put her mind at ease, it did not stop the strange occurrences. A few nights later, when Jennifer was lying in bed while chatting on the phone with friends, the mattress aggressively shook for a few minutes. And when it stopped, she looked under the bed, but again, nothing was there. The next morning, she was hysterical and couldn't keep it to herself. She told Bonnie about what she had experienced, and after seeing how scared and serious Jennifer was about her story, she knew that she wasn't making this up. So Bonnie decided to call a family meeting to discuss what was happening in the house. And that's when everyone learned that each of them had an uneasy feeling about the place. The family then came to the conclusion that their new dream house may have actually been a nightmare. They had no idea what exactly they were dealing with, but they could all sense that it was something malevolent. Bonnie and Sean knew they would need to keep their family safe from whatever this thing was. And that's when Bonnie remembered hearing about a very famous pair of paranormal investigators, Ed and Lorraine Warren. She had first learned about them nearly 20 years earlier, in 1976. That was when the Warrens were dealing with the well-known Amityville haunting involving the Lutz family. And as you guys know, if you've been a listener to the show at all, you've heard about Ed and Lorraine Warren. I mean, some of the biggest cases we've covered here paranormal-wise have been cases from their files. But if you're not familiar for some reason, Ed, he was a very famous demonologist, and Lorraine was a clairvoyant and medium. Husband and wife duo in the paranormal world, and they worked together for about 50 years and did a lot of investigating, covered a lot of different cases. They also created the New England Society for Psychic Research, or NESPR, which still exists today. And over their career, they claimed to have investigated over 10,000 cases. Many of these cases' files have not been released. And according to them, they never charged anything for their investigations. Instead, they made their money by giving lectures and licensing their stories. Their work, of course, has inspired the Conjuring movie universe, which is crazy, has grossed over $1 billion. How about that?
That's nuts.
$1 billion franchise.
That's got to be the biggest grossing horror franchise in history, right?
I would think so. I can't imagine there's any others that come close to a billion. I mean, I'm a huge lover of the Conjuring movie universe. The Conjuring one will forever be my favorite. I'll never forget watching that for the first time in theaters and just being completely out of my element, immersed into story. Is there a bigger franchise?
The Conjuring universe is the highest grossing horror franchise in history, but it does not have the highest grossing horror movie in history. That title goes to It.
Ah, that makes sense. I can see that. But after investigating together for over 50 years, Ed passed away in 2006 after years of failing health, and Lorraine passed away in 2019, naturally in her sleep. But they've left behind a very vast and also controversial legacy, including allegations of sexual abuse against Ed. Many people have also accused them of being outright frauds who preyed on vulnerable families. But others believe their stories regardless. I mean, I think regardless of whether or not you think they're frauds or not, I don't think many of us can deny that their stories are some of the best in the paranormal sphere.
I agree. I mean, as someone who is a resounding skeptic, I still really enjoy their stories. I still enjoy the Conjuring series. They're entertaining.
Yeah. You know, at the very least, fraudsters or not, definitely entertainers or good storytellers.
Exactly.
But the Warrens, you know, they were definitely active during this time period. In 1998, the Warrens actually lived only 20 minutes away from the Beckwith family in the town of Monroe, Connecticut. And as many of you probably know, Ed and Lorraine kept a collection of haunted objects that they accumulated from their investigations over the years. This includes items like the very infamous Raggedy Ann doll, which I wish I had the Raggedy Ann doll, but she's still being kept and is now kind of sort of owned.
Yeah.
By a famous comedian. But I do have a movie replica of Annabelle, of course. Many of you have seen her before. She's now joined me for this episode. And I'm not going to lie to you, I do think that Annabelle may be a vessel for something. And, you know, we've had a psychic medium on the show. She's confirmed there's definitely spirits that inhabit this studio, but definitely some strangeness. And I like to attribute it to Annabelle over here. Even though she is just a movie replica, she's also just awesome to have, I must say. I'm a big fan of Annabelle. But they also have the haunted mirror, which tormented the Smurl family in the late 70s and early 80s. They have a full, like, occult museum, which is now also sort of owned by Mr. Matt Rife. Lorraine, with the help of her son-in-law, Tony Sparrow, eventually turned their home into a museum. And for many decades, it's attracted paranormal lovers, investigators, and occult enthusiasts all over the world. Until 2019, when they actually had to shut it down due to zoning laws, because it's literally a house in a neighborhood.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine the neighborhood felt great about them having the general public coming through their museum. But in August of 2025, as I've kind of keep alluding to, it was announced that the home had been purchased by controversial comedian Matt Rife and former Viner YouTuber Elton Casty, and they have plans to reopen it. They'll also become the legal guardians of the haunted items within the home until 2030, and that's the kind of weirdness to it. They're kind of leasing the museum and the objects, yeah, which is strange. They're kind of just caretakers.
Yeah.
They don't actually own Annabelle, which of course the media went crazy with it.
Oh, of course.
Afterwards, like, oh, the new owner of Annabelle. Like,
no, it's leased. They're leased.
Which I'm honestly glad. I was kind of upset when I found out that Matt Rife bought the house. I was like, oh, him of all people, he's going to now have possession over all these haunted objects and all of the Warren's collections. But nope, they're just the legal guardians till 2030.
And regardless of how you feel about Matt Rife, it just feels weird to me that someone who isn't traditionally in, you know, the paranormal space.
Yeah, yeah.
Owns it. You know, like it just, that it seems off to me.
I agree. And I get it. He claims to have been a, you know, paranormal believer and lover for many, many years. But I can't help but think this is about money for him.
Yeah.
Because they do have plans to open the home for overnight guests.
Oh, 100% it's about money.
For $2,000 a night.
Oh my.
To stay in their home. Yep. So yeah. Big business opportunity,
yeah,
for sure.
That completely makes sense.
But anyways, it is unclear exactly how Bonnie Beckwith got in touch with the Warrens, but either way, they ended up coming to the house the same night they were contacted. Jennifer was initially skeptical of Ed and Lorraine. She even jokingly called them the Ghostbusters, but once she saw how they picked up on what was happening in the home, she almost immediately believed they had special abilities. As soon as they walked in, they felt an intense energy in the home. Lorraine felt uncomfortable and later described the feeling as chilling. She said the home was infested with a heavy presence, and while walking through the home, she felt something staring right at her with a sense of malice and murderous intent. Lorraine entered Jennifer's room and felt an intense, powerful presence with a deeply negative aura. She also became consumed by violence and anger. After assessing the house, the Warrens told the family that an evil entity was haunting it. The Beckwiths wanted to leave, but Ed and Lorraine warned that if they did, there's a very good possibility that this presence will just follow them, so the only way to stop it is to stay and fight. But of course, in order to fight this thing, they need to know what this thing is. What are they up against? So the Warrens instructed them to start gathering some evidence. The family set up video cameras next to their beds, hoping to capture something in the middle of the night. They also kept photo cameras around the house to try and take pictures of the entity. And while they lived in fear, they tried to move on with their lives. Thanksgiving was just around the corner, so Bonnie's mom came for a visit. But the holiday joy didn't last very long because right away, Bonnie's mother felt very uneasy in the house. Still, she just focused on spending time and enjoying that time with her daughter and grandkids. That night, when she was finally alone, she couldn't ignore the feeling that something that wasn't supposed to be there was in the house. Bonnie's mom went to her room and turned on the TV to try and relax, and suddenly the TV turned off. She turned it back on, and it shut off again right away. Then three large dark figures appeared on the dark screen. When she looked over, she saw them standing in the corner, and then they vanished right before her eyes. She didn't sleep at all that night and left first thing in the morning. She couldn't even stay for Thanksgiving. And as she packed and left, Jennifer noticed that she was still shaking. After she ended up leaving, Jennifer went into the room with a camera and started taking pictures. She noticed how cold it was in there. She said it was about 35 degrees. I mean, you're seeing your breath in those types of temperatures, while the rest of the house was in the 70s. So imagine walking into a room and it's basically a refrigerator.
Yeah.
Seeing your breath. But then you walk out of the room.
70 degrees.
Yeah. Oh. What a difference. She took her photos and then quickly left the room. And when the film was developed a few days later, a large orb showed up in one of the pictures. After Thanksgiving, the Warrens came back to the house prepared to face this entity that was troubling the Beckwiths. Ed Lorraine brought along two paranormal investigators and a medium named Lee. Expecting things to get intense, Bonnie and Sean sent young Jeremy to stay with a relative. When they arrived, Lorraine examined the photo Jennifer had taken a few days earlier and assessed that they were dealing with a powerful demon. And at that moment, the medium Lee began to tremble uncontrollably. She grabbed a pen and paper so the spirit could write through her. Basically, automatic writing. She started writing violently, "Get out, get out, get out. You don't belong here. Get out. Get out. Get out." Then all of a sudden, Bonnie felt her energy completely drained, and the same feeling spread to Jennifer. Jennifer later described it as if something had walked through her mom and then into her before exiting. So we already have all of this going on, and even then the activities continue to increase within the home, and the Warrens are still trying to figure out how they can put an end to it. So they asked their investigators to spend the night in the home. Then they then went and set up their equipment in Jennifer's room. And all through the night, they recorded knocking and scratching on the walls. They then came up with a way to talk to the entities. One knock meant yes, and two knocks meant no. And using this method, they were able to learn that there were three human spirits and a demon controlling them. If the demon was banished, then the three human souls would be freed. A few nights later, the Warrens and their team came back, and this time, they wanted to get more answers by having Lee let the entities write through her again. Lee sat at the table with a pen and paper, and Ed sat across from her to ask questions. Ed first asked, "Who are you?" Lee trembled as she wrote, "George, Robert, Anna." And when Ed asked again, "Who are you?" they answered, "George Robertson." Ed then asked, "What year is it?" They wrote 1. And then 8. Lee's hand started to write another 8, but before she could finish, she began to shake. Suddenly, she screamed, "Get out! You don't belong here!" And then she pushed the table with such a strong force that it pinned Ed to the wall. He tried to move it, but Lee kept pushing it back. And she kind of seemed like to Ed that she had superhuman strength, and he wasn't able to move the table off of him. Sean Beckwith and the other two investigators had to pull her away in order to free Ed. Lee kept shaking and screaming until she finally snapped out of it. After the Warrens and their team left that night, the whole Beckwith family moved their mattresses into the living room and tried to sleep side by side. Still, no one was able to get an ounce of sleep. Their minds kept replaying what had just happened, and they were afraid of what might happen next. But they didn't want to give up. The next day, Bonnie and Jennifer set out to learn more about the house's history. They visited the Seymour's town hall and searched through records. That's when they found property records and discovered that the previous owner was George Robertson. He had owned the property in 1888, and Lee had written his name and even started to write the year before the demon stopped her. George Robertson was probably one of three people trapped in the house by the demon. Bonnie and Jennifer tried to find out more about the other two names. Lee wrote Robert and Anna, but they were unable to find any information pertaining to these names, because most of the town's records had been lost in a big flood that happened in 1955, so they weren't able to even learn anything about George Robertson other than his name and year that he died either. As they left the town hall, Jennifer and Bonnie felt compelled to go to a local cemetery. So they drove out there, got out of the car, and the very first gravestone that they saw was in fact George Robertson's. It was as if they had been called straight to it. Oddly enough, after this encounter, things at the house were peaceful and no one experienced any strange occurrences, and the energy felt lighter. The Warrens also sent out a priest who blessed the home, and at first it seemed like the blessing had worked and things remained peaceful around the home. But unfortunately, the demonic entity was prepared to return in full force. It wasn't done with the family. Out of nowhere one day, Bonnie got a massive urge to start drawing. She then grabbed a sketchbook and images began to flow out of her. The drawings absolutely consumed her, and for several days she would spend hours drawing, unable to think of anything else. She became fixated on drawing a tree she couldn't get out of her mind. She barely spoke to her family, focusing only on the sketching on the tree. But after finishing it, she couldn't stop drawing. Even when her hands cramped or she wanted to do something else, she kept drawing strange symbols and images. Next, she started drawing a woman, and Bonnie suddenly felt deeply depressed, and she realized that that woman was Anna, the female spirit trapped inside the house, who seemed to have taken over her mind. Bonnie sensed Anna had suffered a terrible loss and was in great pain, which made Bonnie begin to cry, feeling as if the entities were watching her. When the feeling finally passed, Bonnie studied one of the drawings and realized that it seemed to represent the three people trapped by the demon. One drawing contained a pyramid with light shining at the top. Below it, three floating human figures seemed to represent George, Robert, and Anna. Around this time, Lorraine Warren called to check in with the family, and Bonnie told her about the strange drawing. Lorraine informed her that the spirits were channeling through her and told her to resist the urge to keep drawing. Bonnie put down her pencil, but this seemed to upset the spirits even more, and things only got worse. The family then started experiencing physical attacks from the entities. Jeremy was pushed to the ground and the girls had their hair pulled. One night, all three kids were wrapping Christmas presents upstairs when the door began shaking violently, sending them running downstairs screaming. At this point, Bonnie was exhausted and needed a way to put a stop to everything. She called Lorraine again and begged for assistance. The Warrens had already reached out to a Catholic priest who would perform an exorcism, but he couldn't come until after Christmas. Until then, the family had to do their best to protect themselves from the evil inside their home. But that was proving difficult for the family. At this point, they were all still spending the night in the same room, and none of them were getting much sleep. Bonnie's mom came to stay with them for Christmas, and it was the first time she had returned since she saw the three human entities on her last trip. While she was scared, the family was determined to try and have a normal holiday. But soon after arriving, Bonnie's mom began experiencing an intense fever, and she was rushed to the hospital. They kept her overnight after doctors discovered she had an irregular heartbeat. Bonnie and Jennifer were by her bedside when she asked them to pray with her. But when Bonnie's mom began reciting them, she could only say the prayers backwards, which they were absolutely terrified, and that's when Bonnie decided to call the priest to come bless her mom. And when the priest arrived, Bonnie's mom was doing all right. That quickly changed when he offered her communion. And that's when she felt a harsh pain in her stomach as if someone had viciously punched her. But as soon as she took the communion wafer, it cleansed her of her pain. While all this was happening, Frances, the oldest Beckwith child, was out doing some last-minute Christmas shopping. On her way home, she got into a bad car accident, which totaled her car. She had only minor injuries, but she was very shaken up. The family believed the entities had attached themselves to Frances and Bonnie's mom, even while they were outside the home. The family at this point was reaching their breaking point. But 3 days later, the priest finally arrived to perform the exorcism on the house. Now, before we talk about the exorcism, because you can obviously see where this is going, you know, we have the Warrens coming in, they're identifying this is a demonic entity controlling human spirits, which are trapped in the home. Maybe there's some other explanations possibly that are worth considering, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which, for one, when you take a step back and you just think about Seymour, Connecticut, it does sit in an area known for granite-heavy bedrock. And granite naturally contains trace amounts of radioactive elements such as uranium. And over time, that can produce radon gas, and in some cases, measurable electromagnetic fluctuations, which radon gas is a big deal here in Colorado. You have to get radon systems put into any home with a basement or that's below ground, because it can absolutely cause serious medical side effects, including psychological effects as well. But this is what's interesting, is that obviously there's been a lot of studies out there linking high electromagnetic field exposure, EMF, to anxiety, paranoia, feelings of being watched, shadow figure hallucinations, sudden mood swings, and even the sensation of a presence. And in lab settings, stimulating specific regions of the temporal lobe with magnetic fields has led people to report religious experiences, even as well as out-of-body sensations, and of course, encounters with shadowy figures. Which again, if we think about Jeremy's experiences, including waking up at 11 p.m., seeing a looming black shape, you know, he's feeling frozen in fear, you also have to consider, is he potentially experiencing sleep paralysis? Which we've talked about sleep paralysis many a times on the show, and it's no joke. And Danny's experienced sleep paralysis as well.
I have. It was a...
It's scary, right?
It was scary. You feel helpless, and it's like a nightmare where you want to wake up, but you can't, and you feel awake. It's a terrifying experience. I don't recommend it.
Feels evil, right? You kind of feel trapped, scary.
Yeah.
You potentially think there's something there. People report seeing an entity on their chest.
Yep, I saw that. I think pressure. I talked about it before. Yes, I felt pressure. I felt like I couldn't move, like... It felt like I was being held down, and I think I've talked about it before, but the entity I specifically saw, the closest thing that I can describe what it looked like, and I'll put a picture up on screen, is one of the drawings from Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Oh, yeah.
The children's horror books. It's the one woman where she has no eyes. She was floating at the end of my bed. It was frightening. It really was. Luckily, I haven't had that experience in well over probably 6 years now.
Were you going through a stressful time?
I was going through a stressful time in my life, yeah.
That's what they believe, is that it may have to do with stress or, you know, external factors going on in your life. But sometimes it just happens completely random too.
Yeah.
But terrifying nonetheless. I mean, I've never experienced sleep paralysis. I've had dreams that have felt real, but definitely not a demon on top of me. I have had night terrors though of things descending from the ceiling and seeing things that aren't there. And if you couple that with paranormal investigators coming over saying there's a demonic entity in your house,
it's going to wig you out a bit.
It absolutely is going to make you feel like those hallucinations are real.
100%.
But when talking about some of these other theories and sleep paralysis in general, it doesn't explain multiple family members experiencing activity. Furniture shaking. I mean,
that's hard to explain.
It's hard to explain for sure, right?
And also, I feel bad for Jeremy. I mean, he's a small kid. And first off, his mom told him that the green light was going to protect him from monsters. So now he feels even more helpless. And then even after that, he went under the blanket, which as a child, going under
that's
the blanket,
safe space.
It's a safe space. And then the ghost or the demon just violated it. I feel so bad for Jeremy.
Yeah, I'm sure he's really thinking he's in a monster's den at this point. I mean, 100%. My God, you know, and it also doesn't explain the whole violent table incident that happened with Ed and Lee. Yeah. I mean, what's going on there? It's obviously not sleep paralysis. And could environmental factors play into it? I think it's difficult with this because you have people who, you know, they weren't there that long. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like they had moved in and hadn't been living there, I think, long enough to really be affected by like a slow gas leak or radon gas or right, something.
It was
like
almost
that.
Immediate.
Yeah, it was almost immediate versus I feel like in many environmental situations, it would take quite a while unless there's like some anomaly, yeah. right? That's underneath your home.
Right. Like the potato fungus that we talked about.
Yeah, exactly.
So just right. something like that where it can be immediate, but nothing like that seems to be here.
Yeah. I mean, could there be something under the floorboards that's radioactive or poisonous that's giving off some type of toxic gas that they're breathing in? But, and that's, you know, that's always one of the things with the paranormal, especially with Ed and Lorraine Warren. It's like, did they get the house inspected?
Exactly.
Did they look into, could it be an environmental factor? We have no idea. I mean, it's never reported that they do that, but I like to assume that they did their due diligence and they actually thought about all these other things, but maybe not.
And I like to assume that since they do profit off of licensing their stories, that they do, maybe they aren't lying outright, but it does seem to me that they probably embellish a little bit just to sell it a bit.
Fair.
Just to sell it a bit more.
I think that's definitely fair. Because again, very famous, very controversial. You know, a lot of other cases also follow a similar arc, right? You got families reporting paranormal activity, escalating disturbances. The Warrens come in, and again, it's difficult because we don't have access to the 10,000 cases. There might be 9,000 cases that they came to like a totally logical.
Right.
Conclusion. But the case, as far as the cases that most of us know about, and at least the ones that we've covered, oftentimes they come in and they point to a poltergeist or some type of human entity. But a lot of times it ends up being something demonic, right? And again, they're Catholic. Ed, longtime Catholic guy, also demonologist. That's what his specialty in is identifying demons. So exactly. He's kind of got a bias towards
exactly.
Demons.
Exactly.
And they usually resort to an exorcism being performed as kind of their general way of doing. They bring someone to bless it, come and bless the house or bless the people. And if that doesn't work, then they bring in somebody else. They try to talk to it oftentimes to try to get more information. But most of the times, they end up bringing in a priest who can perform an exorcism and then peace is restored. And like, I think a lot of people also bring up the fact that if you go into a home and you're coming from this position of authority, right? Mm-hmm. That if you tell a family who's like, what's going on here? I'm experiencing all these things. And you're telling them a demon is involved. It's going to fundamentally change how they experience everything in that house.
100%.
A sound, a smell.
100%.
What, you know, something they think they see.
They're now going to try and link it to that
yeah.
instead of trying to find a more logical explanation.
Right. Was that just a kid walking out of the kitchen? No.
Exactly.
That was a demon on the move.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's important to remember that expectations often shape perceptions, right? And so keep that in mind as we go forward. It doesn't mean that the Beckwiths were lying, but in heightened states, when, you know, if you feel like something demonic is there, the brain becomes incredibly sensitive to the environment, right? And sensitive mm-hmm. to what could be just normal environmental stimuli. But it doesn't discount the fact that it can amplify their experience and their levels of fear. And then there's also the factor of, could this also be attributed to psychological stress, the group dynamics of the family? I mean, they had just gone through a big life change. They had just moved into a new home. They're also dealing with financial stress. Moving is very expensive. Setting up a new home is expensive. Sleep deprivation, of course, if you're not sleeping well. I mean, I think we all know, and any parent out there who's been through the newborn phase knows that if you've never experienced sleep deprivation before, you will experience sleep deprivation. And I can't even tell you like how different I am as a human being when I have little sleep. Like I'm only getting a couple hours a night. It absolutely changes your mindset changes the way you're seeing reality in every way, shape, or form. And I'm sure you, Danny, have had sleepless nights or multiple stints of little sleep and just like how crazy you get.
I mean, your hormones go completely out of whack. Your perception of time warps. You start hearing things. You have I personally, especially when I get really tired, I get auditory hallucinations, stuff like that. Not to the degree of being a new parent. I know that's a whole different ballgame, but the lack of it's been proven scientifically that the lack of sleep does have negative effects on the body and can alter your perception of the world around you. It's just, sleep is so important that when it gets affected, it just compounds every other thing going on with you.
So if you're not getting sleep because you're hearing all this crazy paranormal activity going on, you got knocking and things slamming around, flying off shelves, and you're just paranoid all night that you're being tormented by these entities that are inhabiting this new house you lived in. So if you compound all that together, it could be pretty stressful, right? Yeah,
I would agree.
And your environment's just continuing, as you aren't sleeping and your environment is not getting better, it can be, I'm sure it can cause anybody to go mad. I mean, you're going to be like, what is going on here? There must be something in this house that is tormenting me. But, you know, something to consider again, other people come in, haven't been staying there per se, claim to have experienced things. But I think it's a very valid thing that you have to bring up. And of course, there's also the other factor of, we don't know exactly the history of this house. We don't know who was there before Mr. Robertson. We don't know what may have happened in the house while Mr. Robertson lived there. Could there have been a death? Could somebody have taken their own life? Could there have been something tragic that happened? There's a lot that we still don't know, because again, historical records for that property were destroyed. And so something very traumatic could have happened there. And maybe that could be the source. Maybe it has something to do with a tragic event as opposed to a demonic possession happening in the home. But I think when you consider all factors here, it creates a much more complicated picture that there could be a lot more going on here than just a cut and dry demonic entity and other spirits inhabiting the home. I mean, the house could be on Native American burial grounds. I mean, that's long been reported to cause paranormal activity amongst other things. So there's so many other things that could be at play here. But of course, the Warrens come in, they immediately identify what's going on, that it's a demon, that it kind of seems like they maybe skirt past other possibilities here. But regardless of all this, it's very obvious that the Beckwith family believed that they were absolutely under attack. And with Christmas approaching, you got the holidays on top of it. That's already a stressful time for most of us, getting ready for the holidays and gifts and dinners and all that kind of stuff. That's, you add that stress in there too. I mean, I feel like some of us have paranormal experiences just from the stress of the holidays. It can be incredibly stressful. But things are only going to escalate. So as many of you know, exorcisms are usually performed on people, but in this case, the priest and the Warrens had to come up with a new approach. They decided that the medium, Lee, would channel the entities, and once they entered her, they would begin the exorcism. Lee fully consented to being restrained, so the Warrens team strapped her down to a chair and the priest began the ritual. And almost immediately, the demon took control of Lee's body and started lashing out. She began screaming while thrashing in the chair, and she yelled out, "Stop praying! It's not going to do you any good." And it's very obvious Lee is just filled with pain. She's just squirming around. But the priest did not let this break his concentration, and he continued saying his rites. The priest then placed a holy cross on Lee's forehead and her screaming stopped. She then looked at him with a devilish smile and then stood up so forcefully that the chair legs broke. And despite this, the priest is still not intimidated. But the Warren's two researchers then held her down while he kept on praying. The exorcism lasted about an hour before Lee suddenly went quiet and slumped over. After this, the whole house fell quiet, and the dark energy seemed to fade. replaced by a feeling of peace and light. And it seemed like whatever this entity was, if it was a demon, it was gone. And at this point, with the demon exorcised from the house, the human spirits were free to leave at last. And after that day, the Beckwith family enjoyed a peaceful life in their home, and they were finally able to move on with their lives. But their encounters with the paranormal were not entirely over as they thought. A few years after the exorcism, a real estate developer bought the property across the street, and when construction started, workers accidentally dug up a Native American burial ground. And for a while, the Beckwiths heard strange noises and doors slamming, but it was never as intense as their earlier experiences. Bonnie said that this whole experience changed her faith. She later stated, "I came into this house pretty much an atheist, and now I've seen the powers of God. I've also seen the powers of the devil right before my very eyes, and it's made me a stronger person." In 2005, the paranormal themed show A Haunting featured the family's story in an episode titled Hell House. Bonnie and Jennifer, as well as Lorraine Warren, all participated in interviews for it, and the show took the Beckwith story nationwide. Joseph Madry, the show's producer, later said that the family was really happy with the episode. Bonnie told him it was more accurate and more frightening than she was expecting. They even hosted a party on Halloween and played clips of the episode to their guests. And before this, the story of the Beckwith family went largely overlooked, mostly due to being overshadowed by the more well-known haunting that many of us know about, the Snedeker family in Southington, Connecticut, which was only about 30 minutes away from Seymour. And today that case is widely known for the inspiration behind the film A Haunting in Connecticut, of course, which I covered a long, long, long time ago, episode 33, if you're interested in checking that one out. But eventually, the Beckwith family left that home in 2009, and it was purchased by a man who lived somewhere overseas, who actually didn't even see the house before acquiring it. And it was actually part of a deal with two other foreclosed properties. But over the years, he struggled to find consistent tenants, and the home sat empty for long periods of time. In 2021, police reported that five men and a woman were arrested for breaking into the house on a Friday the 13th. The reason's unclear, but over the years, many people have entered the empty house to perform seances. And I get it. I get why people do it.
Yeah.
You know, if you really believe it's haunted, I mean, that's the place to do it. Do a seance. Around the same time, the owner was attempting to sell the house, but was really struggling to find buyers. And when asked if she believed there was any paranormal activity in the home, she stated, "If you want to buy a haunted house, it's a haunted house. And if you don't want to buy a haunted house, then it's not haunted." Which, there you go. I mean, I think it's how a lot of us may look at this particular story, and as a, you know, in general, is if you want to look at it as a haunted house, it's haunted. But otherwise, if you're not into it,
yeah,
then it's just a house. And while it's unclear if or when it sold, it does appear that the home is now occupied. But the house has become a very popular spot for ghost hunters. In 2023, the New England Society for Psychic Research said it had been studying the home, and on one visit, they found a small plant eerily growing out of the concrete basement floor. It was kind of wild, just like one single plant.
That is kind of weird.
Yeah. Huh. But a lot of people dispute that the home is still haunted. Dan Rivera, the founder of the CT Old School Paranormal, once said to the press, "From past history, what happened there, I think it was pretty much done with from back then. I really don't think there's anything going on right now with it." And if that name sounds familiar to you, that's because he was widely talked about when he suddenly passed away last year while working on the nationwide tour with the actual Annabelle the Doll. He had been working as her handler and passed away in his hotel room in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Annabelle wasn't in the room, but people still insinuated that, of course, she caused his death. However, we know this to not be true because an autopsy was performed later on and it revealed that he had passed away from a heart attack, and he was he had an extensive history of heart issues, so there's that. But while this might just be a coincidental connection to the Beckwith family, it's one of the many strange details that surrounds this house on Buckingham Road. And whether what happened in 1998 was a case of demonic infestation or psychological contagion, environmental interference, or something we don't yet have the language for, and one thing remains true. For months, a family believed that something was inside the house, and this thing wanted them gone. And this was a very terrifying stretch of time for them. I think with any of these paranormal stories, I don't think you can discount their experience. I think their experience was real. I think they had some type of experience with the paranormal. I just don't know if you can directly attribute it to a demonic entity. I think that is absolutely up to debate. But I think enough things happen and they experience, and enough people experience things in this house that there's definitely something up with it. But of course, Danny, what do you think?
I mean, you probably know what I think, but
do you think that they were just making this up from the sense of they wanted a paranormal story for potential financial gain? Or do you think
the family or the Warrens?
Both, but the family first.
No, I don't think the family had any sort of ulterior motive to this. I genuinely think they were experiencing something negative. I don't know what it was. It was obvious that Francis was uncomfortable in the house in the first place, and then the children had some negative experiences. So I don't want to discount their experiences and their fear. I don't think the family in general had any sort of, like I said, I don't think they have an ulterior motive to, you know, try and make a profit off of this. Warrens, I'm always wary of them because, you know, of the controversies of their past experiences and the fact that, you know, they do have the highest grossing horror film franchise in the world. So
they have something to gain for sure.
Exactly.
You can't discount that.
Exactly. And the family didn't have a lot to gain from this. There's not a lot of images of them. Their names aren't really out there. So they,
what did they benefit from this?
Yeah. They didn't really benefit from it at all. I don't see how they benefited from this whatsoever besides not experiencing this anymore. So I believe the family, but as always, Ed and Lorraine Warren, I'm always skeptical of.
Yeah, it's like they get fed these leads, right?
Yeah.
Their name gets out there, and then they just had endless stories that they could pull from. And from what we know, they didn't charge to help or investigate, but they did get the story.
Yeah.
You know, and they did insert themselves in the story. Because it'd be interesting to also see other paranormal teams go in there, mm-hmm. especially at the time that the Beckwiths were there, and get like second opinions from to see what they observed and get more evidence. And that's like, I think all of our biggest issue with the Warrens is, where's the evidence?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And the fact that they're like, here, you guys get the evidence. Here's the cameras. You do it.
Yeah, you do the. You
We're
get
telling
the
you what it is, so you capture it.
And I think part of the reason why they don't charge people for their services is because it kind of gives them it gives them a little wiggle room socially. Like,
oh, we'll help you, but we'll
exactly.
We get kind of like rights to the story. You know?
Exactly.
It's like kind of this like exchange, this trade that we do.
Exactly. There's no paperwork about it.
Right.
Nothing like that. And if there's nothing that's there, they don't get a story. But if they do get a story, they can embellish it. Because I don't know. Do you think there's maybe some sort of legality they have to skirt around if they did charge for the services and then they embellish the story for licensing reasons? Do you think there's any sort of legal issues there that they were trying to avoid by not charging for their services? It's just a question that popped in my head.
Yeah, I think so. I think, there's obvious, like, then you have to do contracts. There'd be liability there.
Yeah.
If it's all verbal agreements, there's nothing that can be.
There's nothing concrete. There's no paper trail.
It'd be very difficult to go and sue them or try to come after them.
And then you probably wouldn't want to sue them if they were the ones that did end up helping you with whatever issue was in your house.
Totally. And I think with Lee channeling the entities, I mean, Lee was brought in by them.
Right.
Right. And so is it possible if they were hoaxing sort of this whole possession? I mean, it's hard to not think that when the Warrens brought in Lee and their team, and like, are they all kind of working together to put this story together to create another amazing haunting episode, right? Like, it's hard not to think that.
Yeah. And I think, as much of a skeptic as I am, I don't see Ed and Lorraine, because they said they have over 1,000 cases. I don't think
10,000
cases. there's no way that every single one of those cases is paranormal. That's just, it's just, I think even Ed and Lorraine Warren would agree with that.
Totally.
But I think when they do find a case that has enough things that they can kind of twist into a story is when they kind of start getting their gears turning. They bring in other people. They start feeding these ideas, at least my personal opinion. I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think when they find a good story like this, that's when they kind of start embellishing everything. And those are the ones that get famous. The ones that have just this little bit of paranormal aspect to them, and then they just kind of fluff everything else up, my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, they're like good TV producers.
Yeah.
They're like good reality TV producers. Yeah. They come in, and like, I legitimately think the family was potentially dealing with paranormal activity.
Yeah.
The knock, you know, like, I think they were scared.
Yeah.
And they were hearing things. Because again, I go back to, it's Native American burial ground. Like there's absolutely things that have happened there. Cursed land, potential, like there's things that you can point to that would absolutely make sense for there to be paranormal activity. I think when the Warrens come and get involved, they absolutely escalate it. They're like, which is funny because they come in, they stir up the demon or whatever, they stir up the entity, or hell, maybe Lorraine connects with whatever entity's there, pisses it off, and then they leave. And then when they call them back, hey, it's not getting better, they come back, and then they kind of bring in, you know, bring in the priest, and they always approach the paranormal also from the Catholic perspective too.
That's another comment I was going to have. It's interesting that, this is more of a theological question, but it's interesting that the Catholic exorcism seems to work in all of these cases.
Yes, right.
What about hauntings that happen in the Eastern Hemisphere?
Yeah.
Like,
let's get a pagan witch in here.
Exactly. Or the pagan witch, or like, I don't know much about a lot of Easter, but like what is that Japanese demon, the Japanese demon that we've talked about before?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
The yokai? Is that it?
Yeah, what do they call the Catholic priest in?
Yeah, like, how do they deal with it? Like, it's interesting to me how we've classified, at least in the Western world, that most of these, most of like the paranormal issues that the paranormal entities that we deal with come from Catholicism, Christianity, stuff like that. But we don't really talk about any other ones. Like, we've mentioned the Dybbuk and the Dybbuk box,
yeah.
But even then, we don't really hear a lot about a Dybbuk haunting houses. It's always a Christian or Catholic demon.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Yeah. Why is it always like a Bible-derived demon? You know, it's always like biblically traced back to some period within the Bible. But yet we never hear about, you know, an evil spirit from like Native American or indigenous cultures that is like causing, because like all of the religions and all of the different faiths of the world all talk about evil spirits and evil entities and stuff, but we don't see those types of entities being identified and then exercised.
Right. And I don't think there's different, like, I obviously, like, different religions have different like names for the entities and demon stuff, but I think they're all the same.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's a different classification for the same thing. Like a Japanese Oni and a Catholic demon, same
negative energy. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But just different names for them.
Yeah.
But it's just interesting to me how each culture has a different way of dealing with them that somehow seems to work. I don't know. Just.
Yeah. No, it's a really good point. Cause I think depending on how they asked a shaman to come in.
Yeah.
Like a shaman would have been very capable of dealing with this situation, or like I said, bring a witch in to deal with it. But I mean, I think it's just the time period for one, but also like that's just who they knew.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, Ed and Lorraine Warren were everywhere. They're on TV, they're doing talk shows, they're in newspapers and stuff. So I think they were just so well known, especially in this region.
100%. And the US is predominantly, you know, Christian Catholic.
Right.
So it's just going to be the most believed. Yeah. Nobody's going to be saying, oh my gosh, it's an Obake in Connecticut. No, they're not going to.
Yeah. Right. So I 100% agree with you. I think the Warrens were always there to swoop in to help, in quotes. But ultimately they were looking for another story. I mean, to add to their collection, they wrote a number of books. And I think they maybe did some paranormal investigating. I think maybe they, you know, maybe Lorraine really did have psychic abilities and was a clairvoyant and stuff. And, you know, and I think a lot of the people they work with would probably say that they helped them.
Yeah. At least gave them some sort of peace of mind.
Totally.
Like I said, 10,000 cases, not all of them are going to be demons. I'm sure a lot of the times when they came in, they said, hey, it's not demons. It's just bad wiring. It's just a leaky faucet, these things like that. It brought those people peace of mind.
Totally. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think it was absolutely real haunting. I just think that I don't necessarily agree with the fact that this was a demonic entity involved here, because it seems like that was only confirmed until Lorraine and Ed came, and then they brought their medium in, mm-hmm. which also identified the demon. You know what I mean? So yeah. Clearly, their knowledge is in line with Ed's knowledge as a mm-hmm. demonologist. So it'd been interesting to bring in a completely independent team from them to see what they would have to say about it, because maybe they would have identified it as something completely different, or even just a poltergeist or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's how the Ed and Lorraine files go.
That's true.
They usually follow that similar arc and end in an exorcism, and you know, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, we're good to go.
Yep.
You know?
I would love to see a haunted location and have a bunch of different spiritual mediums from a bunch of different cultures come in.
Right? Wouldn't that be interesting?
That'd be so interesting to see. It would be like a great science experiment.
Yeah.
I would love that.
Take them to one of the most haunted locations on the planet and see what they come up with.
Get a priest, a shaman, a rabbi.
Right.
Like, get them all in there.
See what they come up with.
Yeah.
New reality show. That'd be crazy. It's like Survivor. But it's all mediums and psychics. That'd be insane.
I'd watch it.
Yeah, it'd be interesting, though. Wild story, regardless, though. Yeah. You know, they never disappoint. At the end of the day, I point to the Native American burial ground. I think there's something to that, and I think there's something to potentially what happened with the Robertson family that lived there as well. Because, you know, I like to think the paranormal is it as more of imprinting upon location, especially when talking about like a house that's haunted, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Versus thinking there's like this, you know, demon from hell that's just living inside the home, you know, hiding in there.
Like, you think it would have more important things to do, other activities to do,
right?
You know what I mean? Like, it's
then trap three human souls there.
Yeah. Because to my knowledge, demons aren't trapped on a location. They can travel. They can go to different places.
They're not bound by reality.
So why would they why would the demons stay there and just keep three souls trapped for no purpose?
Sounds pretty convenient.
Yeah, it is pretty convenient.
It's usually how it goes, man.
It's not always demons, Ed.
It's not. Well, no, it was about a lot of other things for Ed. Yeah, there's a lot more to Ed. We have another episode where we dive into Ed and Lorraine Warren in more detail. If you're more interested in their controversies and the sexual abuse allegations from Ed, it's pretty shocking what happened there. We'll link that episode for you below. But we're going to go on and wrap up today's episode there. Definitely let us know your thoughts about the Beckwith haunting. What do you think happened? What is the most likely scenario when it comes to what was tormenting this family in their home? We want to know. But again, thank you all for your support. Appreciate you. And we'll be back next week with another one. Till then, lights out, everybody.